Good afternoon, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC, and your host. A quick introduction today, and then on to our guest, Dr. David Wormser of the Center for Security Policy. The JPC was founded in 1985 to provide perspectives and analyses of foreign and domestic policy by scholars, academics, and commentators. You can find us on our website, jewishpolicycenter.org. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. There you can sign up for our Insight articles and our magazine In Focus Quarterly. The winter issue of In Focus was devoted to the awakening in the American Jewish community that followed the events of October 7th. The spring issue, which is also up, is devoted to Israel's battle for security for its own people. And the summer issue is coming. We call it domestic policy. But I think the line between domestic policy and foreign policy for us has been blurred since October 7th. I personally wanted to call the issue schizophrenia, but never mind. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. Right now, our most important job is to support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. And now more than ever, we support the government of Israel and the IDF in their defense of the people of Israel and in bringing the perpetrators of the massacres, rapes, hostage taking, and rocket barrages to justice and making Hamas and its fellow travelers release the hostages. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, free speech, and intellectual diversity. So today we are headed off on what some people think of as a bit of a tangent, but in fact it isn't. While most of us are watching the unfolding situation on Israel's northern border, Hezbollah has ramped up its rocket and missile fire into Israel, but only as much as it thinks it can without engendering a big response. And Israel is responding in a limited and targeted way. American pressure, however, appears to be on Israel not to escalate, presumably not to aggravate Iran. But while all of that is going on and the war in Gaza continues, to Israel's south, there is another Iran-managed war, primarily against the United States, by Iran's proxies, the Houthis. The Houthis claim that they are attacking shipping that's going to Israel, as well as American naval vessels. But in the first 2 months of 2024, traffic into the Suez Canal dropped by 50% from a year earlier, forcing international trade to take the long way around Africa, which drives up costs and lengthens supply chains and does a whole lot of other things to a whole lot of other countries. American retaliation has been largely, I don't want to say non-existent, but mostly we defend against and not retaliate for. This week, the Houthis sunk a British cargo ship and killed a sailor, and followed that with an attack that sunk a Greek coal ship. Add to the mix, the Houthis are actively working with China, which has a base in Djibouti. And now we get to what we're doing here today. All of this, our guest, Dr. David Wormser, says, undermines one of the primary functions of the United States Navy, which is to be the guarantor of freedom of the seas. Dr. Wormser is a senior analyst for Middle East Affairs at the Center for Security Policy in Washington. He's also a fellow at the Miskav Institute for National Security and Zionist Strategy in Israel. In his spare time, he's the executive and founding member of the Delphi Global Analysis Group. They specialize in geopolitical risk analysis and mitigation for companies in the U.S., Japan, and India navigating in Israel. Got more complicated last October. His government service includes having been senior advisor to the U.S. National Security Advisor. He was also senior advisor on Middle East Proliferation and Strategic Affairs to Vice President Cheney and a senior advisor to Undersecretary of State John Bolton. He is a military veteran. He had 11 years, in the U.S. Navy, reserves reaching the rank of lieutenant commander. David holds degrees in political science, international affairs, international economics, and foreign policy from the Johns Hopkins University. You can find his work in the Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, and commentary among other places, and here at the JPC. David Wormser, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Shoshana. I really appreciate it. I'm going to start with just a few sort of statistics or numbers just to show how important this is, but I won't belabor the point very much. But it does show that this is not just an issue, but a major issue. First of all, shipping, because of this, has to go around. A lot of shipping has to go around the Horn of Africa, not Horn of Africa, actually, through the Cape of Good Hope, adding 2 to 3 weeks in shipping. Shipping cost for a 40-foot container on average from Asia to Europe went up from $700 to roughly $4,000 to $5,000 per container. 16% of all traffic had been passing through Suez before the war, and 30% of all container shipping had been passing through Suez before the war. In 2022, 22,000 ships passed through the Suez Canal. And I say Suez Canal because one just remind one of the geography. Yemen is opposite Somalia and Eritrea and Ethiopia. And it's a couple dozen miles, the Straits of Bab el-Mandeb, that lead from the Indian Ocean into the Red Sea and from the Red Sea through the Suez Canal into the Mediterranean. So one always has to remind oneself of the geography of this. So when I say Suez, it's part of what's cut off here. Now, what's happened? First of all, insurance rates of shipping have gone up from 0.6% of the cargo total to 2% of the cargo total. These are huge costs. Container traffic is down. Just from December 2023 to January 2024, it shot down 82% through the Red Sea, Suez Canal. The U.S. East Coast has been hit harder than the West Coast. Costs of shipping from North Asia to the U.S. East Coast, which pass through the Suez Canal, have risen 137%. But the press on demand of shipping containers and shipping that is now taken up by these longer journeys, the West Coast has also increased from Asia, and it's increased by 130%. Then there are some strategic influences here, or that it has an impact strategically. First of all, food from Europe going to the littoral of Africa had already been damaged. The trade had already been under great stress because of the Ukraine war. And now the food can't go through the Suez Canal down southward toward the littoral of Africa, the eastern littoral of Africa, causing tremendous prices of food to increase in that area and increasing the pressure toward famine and so forth. The East African littoral is also the source of a tremendous amount of raw materials for the European industrial sector. And the trade going northward has been largely cut and it has to go around the Cape of Good Hope in Africa. So that led, for example, in February, both Volvo and Tesla to shut down their European facilities producing cars. Egypt is affected particularly by this. About $500 million a month in revenue is lost. In February 2022, for example, when you do month by year by year, the same month in a year over the same month next year, in February 2022, there were about 1,600 ships passing the Suez Canal with about $500 million in revenue. But in February 2024, there were 5 ships. And that's a huge impact on Egypt. By and large, the global economy, it's estimated, is paying about $400 million per hour of delays that are caused by this. And if you do the math, that means 2 to 3 weeks of extra days at $400 million an hour, that's $5 billion per day, or $70 to $100 billion per year. That this is costing. Estimates by UNCTAD, the United Nations Committee on Trade and Development, say that the decline of passage through the Red Sea is 62% down in 2024 over the same period in 2023. Israel has suffered tremendously because half the port workers now in Eilat are laid off. This is an industrial and a labor issue now in Israel. Almost all Israeli car imports come through the southern port through a lot, and that's come to a halt. And the vital potash trade that Israel depends on, it's one of its few raw materials that it used to, that is traditionally exported, going out of Eilat has stopped essentially. So Israel's southern port of Eilat is essentially now paralyzed. And that has tremendous implications because the industry is based on this trade from the port mostly, and tourism. Of course, tourism, because of the war, has also declined, and it's been supplemented by the other thing that the Houthis are doing, which is shooting missiles at Eilat. So overall, Eilat as a port is suffering, and its population is suffering. Eilat, of course, strategically is a land bridge. It breaks the land bridge between Asia and Africa and the Arab world. So for Israel, the thriving of Eilat is a major strategic imperative. Now, the trade is important. The impact on trade is important to the level of being strategic. But I really think the larger impact is the overlay on larger strategic forces that this now raises. Specifically, let's start with Egypt. Egypt now has a choice to make. Well, let me go back for a second. China and Russia. What you started seeing with the Houthis, and this is a very dangerous structure, is they started negotiating through the auspices of Iran with China and Russia to guarantee that Chinese and Russian ships can pass through these areas safely. And then they started essentially a registry of ships that can pass through this area safely without being attacked by the Houthis. What you're seeing is emerging a Chinese, Russian, Houthi, Iranian maritime security initiative that essentially governs the safe traffic through the Suez Canal. Obviously, nations that are at odds with China or don't pay China the proper homage, nations that are at war with Yemen and Iran, including Israel, and generally, Western countries do not have access to this structure. And therefore, they A, cannot pass through safely. B, they will have to pass through Africa, meaning that the industries attached to the United States or Israel or so forth are competitively damaged by the increased prices of their goods. But most importantly, I think what you're seeing is the replacement of what had been America's role for last 250 years, which assumed the mantle from Great Britain of being the dominant naval force that guarantees freedom of navigation across the world. And all of a sudden now, what you're seeing is an alternative structure emerging. First of all, that proves the United States at this point unable to guarantee free shipping in the world. Whether we're unable really or unwilling is the real question. I'd argue we are able, but not willing. But nevertheless, the impact is globally. People are beginning to see this maritime initiative that is emerging under the auspices of China, Russia, and Iran as perhaps a safer bet for their shipping, or at least a supplement to betting their shipping gets through, than the American security overlay in being part of the Western structure. This is, I think, probably one of the most grave damages that can be done to American global power, because really the world depends on the United States maintaining freedom of the seas. The naval power of the United States is the sine qua non of world order. Without it, the disorder begins to become unmanageable. So I think this is the beginning of something very dangerous emerging under China and Russia and Iran. Second, the attachment to the Belt and Road Initiative and China's access to the port structures, critical port structures around the world, especially those in littoral Africa, which contain the titanium, the lithium, the cobalt, a lot of the critical raw materials and rare earth materials out there. China is already dominating the internal structures of transport to the ports of Africa. And now you would have to pay homage to China. You'd have to be part of this initiative to get it out of China. And for example, Japan relies almost entirely on its titanium. What United States relies on titanium from Japan. We get 90% of our titanium sponge from Japan. Japan gets all of its titanium from Madagascar. Now you will see the need to essentially allow China to govern whether that shipping gets from Africa to us or to Japan and to us safely. So the impact is great. Then you have a country like Egypt, where Egypt has relied and has been part of the West, relying on the security of the West to secure the Suez Canal and to make sure the Suez Canal is a properly functioning structure of income for Egypt. But now all of a sudden, Egypt faces a choice. Which camp does it side with? Does it side with the United States, which gives it $2 or $3 billion of aid? I'm not sure exact number. Shoshana might know this better than me, but it's 2 to 3 billion. Or do they side with Russia and China and continue to get proper income through the Suez Canal because of this, as well as their ships? Remember, Egypt itself depends on shipping through the Bab el-Mandeb Straits. So the economic impact of that is severe. And if Egypt begins to, it's at the precipice now, which geopolitical bloc does it go toward? And if it chooses the Russian-Chinese one, this would have a grave impact on their relationship to Israel, because the peace with Israel is in part a payment, a down payment by Egypt for its relationship with the West. One must remember Sadat didn't wake up one morning and decide to be a rabid Zionist. He did what he did because he saw the Soviet Union as, he was very perceptive and saw the Soviet Union as having reached a certain sort of zenith of power. And he understood the future lay with the West, and he shifted to the West and understood making peace with Israel was part of that. So that calculation can go away, as well as the fact that the United States, I mean, not related to this topic, has really not been on its side in various issues in North Africa, and instead sided more with Turkey and with the Muslim Brotherhood and so forth in Libya, for example. So you could see Egypt going away, and this alternative bloc. And then it becomes part, if this alternative block of maritime strategy emerges, it fits perfectly with what we see on the global scale with Putin and Xi in China. Essentially, Putin's concept of the Eurasian strategic architecture governing the world to replace the West. This has been this project of Putin's lately. And this could be a major cornerstone of establishing such a global strategic architecture for this Eurasian concept that Putin pushes. So this is, I think, a tremendous strategic blow to the United States. Is there any good news that could come with it? Well, the Israelis are good at making lemonade out of lemons, and they're working with India to create an overland route to replace the Suez Canal. And you see it, it's called the MTETC, the Middle East Transit Corridor, which relies on peace with Saudi Arabia and the UAE, and I believe peace with Saudi Arabia will come, not under this administration, and for two reasons, just very quickly. One is because the forceful reinjection of the Palestinian veto over peace with Saudi Arabia guarantees there will be no peace with Saudi Arabia, because the Iranians control the Palestinian veto, and therefore they will veto that rapprochement. And second of all, the Saudis are quite bitter still at the Biden administration. They're not willing to make peace while the Biden administration is still in charge. All their terms and demands are really, I think, meant to sabotage it. So I think there will be peace with Saudi Arabia, but it'll take another couple of years, a year or two. And this Middle East Transit Corridor is already beginning. Trucknet has already established an overland trucking route that goes from the UAE across the northern part of this Arabian Peninsula through Jordan to Israel and out Israeli ports. You see the Indians already having a major presence in Haifa port through Adani and the ownership. They're already very heavily in the UAE. So I see this huge overland structure emerging that anchors land traffic as well as oil and gas traffic going east and west between Asia and the Mediterranean. So I think the Israelis could find workarounds for this. The Arab world may find a workaround for this, but one cannot get around the fact that this is a work around the failure of American power. The real strategic problem here is the collapse of American power. This is far more important, really, for the United States than for Israel to get right, and we're not doing it. So that sets it up, kind of, but I think we can leave a lot for questions and discussion here.
So there's definitely a lot there for discussion. So you talked about the structure, their structure, which is the China, Russia, Iran, and the Houthis. Our structure is called CENTCOM. Mm-hmm. What are we doing there? It wasn't the idea of being in having CENTCOM, being in CENTCOM, and then bringing Israel into CENTCOM. Wasn't it meant to ensure security in the Red Sea? What happened to us?
Well, I think CENTCOM, this is what its core function is. By the way, it's a core function of the United States Navy overall. It's one has to remember, the U.S. Constitution makes it very clear. The U.S., in the Constitution, the U.S. shall maintain a navy and raise an army. What it means is that when we're threatened, the navy holds the line. The navy in peacetime guarantees the freedom of the seas because we ultimately see ourselves maybe a big continent, but we're an island, and an island relies on trade for its industry. So therefore, the freedom of the seas has been ever since the beginning of our republic, a core American strategic interests. And that's why it says maintain a navy and raise an army. When the navy then holds the line and then the army is raised while we're under attack. So we're failing in this mission. CENTCOM, regardless of its regional mission, primarily has to maintain the sea lines of communication, two of which run through the Middle East. One is the Straits of Hormuz and the other one is the Bab el-Mandeb Straits. And we're failing in the Bab el-Mandeb Straits. We haven't been tested yet fully in the Hormuz Straits. Now, why are we failing? One is I think there's a perception. I think there's two or three reasons. One is I think the overall one, that this administration is deep down still committed to a JCPOA 2.0. Now, JCPOA is the Iran-US nuclear deal. This is not a nuclear deal. This is a regional condominium deal that we are pursuing. We are trying to come to a strategic understanding with Iran to create a regional condominium and calm the region down. We think we can come to terms with Iran on that. So we're so eager, I would say even desperate, to avoid conflict with Iran to disprove or to destroy that image. That's why I call it JCPOA 2.0. It's really far more than that, though. Well, that's one thing. So we don't really want to confront the Houthis for real and Iran robustly, number one. Number two, I think we have a Navy problem. If you look at how many of our ships, I believe seven of our carriers are in service right now. So we actually have a real pinch on our carrier battle groups. And this speaks, I think, to the need. And this is the general question. We're dealing with munitions to Israel and to Ukraine and to Korea and Japan. We are entering a global strategic competition, and we are not industrially mobilizing to do that. Now, I realize a carrier started now comes online in a decade or two. So whatever we really commit to now is for a decade from now in terms of a carrier. But overall, I think that there's a very real peacetime demeanor to our Navy, to our armed forces, and our industrial support of that, that is inappropriate to the strategic circumstances we now face. And I think that's part of the reason why so many carriers are currently under service, and we only have five to seven left to do everything. And we have currently great tensions in Korea, great tensions in Taiwan and the Philippines. We have one carrier out in the Mediterranean, we have to keep maintaining carriers in the Atlantic North and South. We're really in a real pinch here. So I think the combination of strategic complacence combined with a flawed strategic belief that we can solve this by essentially appeasing Iran and coming to a strategic condominium with it is exacerbating the circumstance and leading to a non-resolution. Instead, our combatants in the Red Sea are pretty much just stopping missiles that happen to be in an area they can shoot it down. And unfortunately, some ships are not in that area and then they get hit. Purely defensive.
So let's do the big piece first, then I'll go do the sort of smaller piece. You talked about looking for an arrangement with Iran, looking for some mechanism to for the United States not to see Iran as an enemy. Is that a result, first of all, is that a result of not having capability to address Iran militarily if we need to? So we look at ourselves and say, look, we can't fight this war, so let's go talk to these people. It's a kind of appeasement thing out of necessity, or is it an appeasement thing out of a belief that this is all okay? And if it's the second, if Iran seems to our government to be an okay interlocutor, it's not just Israel that gets the short end of that stick. It means that we write off Lebanon and Iraq and Syria and the Gulf states, because they'll have no choice but to cave to Iran. But essentially, we're writing off Iraq and Syria and Lebanon and Israel and the Palestinians, and they're never going to be the kinds of countries they could be. And have we given them all away to Iran?
Well, yes, I think we have given them away to Iran. I think it's a combination of ideology and realism. The ideological has led to, I think, to some extent, the realistic shortfall. And the realistic shortfall confirms the ideological. But there is an answer to the shortfall. The answer to the shortfall is you can anchor American interests in the region in one of two ways. You can come to terms with Iran, concede our allies. I doubt it'll work because in the Middle East, either you're the strong horse who offers something, or you're the lame donkey who doesn't. And if you're the donkey, nobody is going to side with you, and nobody will take you seriously. So Iranians will play with us like a cat plays with the dead mouse, and it will just we will be facing a catastrophic collapse of any influence or position in the region, the more we try to appease the Iranians to bridge the gap between our capabilities and our interests. The more we subcontract to the Iranians, the more it exposes the fact that we really don't have a Lebanese army. We don't really have that's independent of Hezbollah. We don't have a security architecture in the region that can survive Iran's predominance, and therefore Saudi Arabia and UAE and others scurrying to try to draw curry favor with Tehran. All that collapses. So the very attempt to appease Iran will actually accelerate the destruction of American position in the region rather than make it solvent. The real way to anchor the region is the opportunity. And I was there on October 7th in Israel. I know what the cost is. I was watching the smoke rise. I had friends who were hurt. I was facing the missiles. I know the trauma, and I'm not going to belittle it. Israel's facing a horrific circumstance. But October 7th was also an opportunity. The opportunity is that Israel can emerge as a powerful nation. It can turn its initial defeat on October 7th into a stunning strategic victory. If it had full American backing to do so. If the United States made its strategic priority the stunning victory of Israel, not locally against Hamas, but regionally against Iran, through Hamas, through Hezbollah, and through Iran directly, then I think you can fundamentally create a Western alliance structure that anchors to Israeli power, Saudi Arabia, UAE, you can create an alternative power structure to Iran. It was emerging before the war, but damaged because of the image of damage to Israel's strength that emerged from the war. So I think what really, America faces a very stark binary choice here. Does it help Israel win decisively and anchor itself in the region powerfully to a regional alliance that allows America to more or less reduce its presence, because such a powerful alliance carries an awful lot of the burden of our defense in the region? Or do we try to appease Iran, in which case we catastrophically collapse anyway? I really think we're in a binary choice like that.
And it's conceivable, I suppose, that the question won't be answered until after the next U.S. election. But you talk about the United States could bolster Israel and Israel could be the anchor, and then all of these kinds of things could happen. We have a question that came in from a listener who says, why don't the U.S. and major naval allies put an end to the Houthi threat now? So we're talking about this at the mega level, which is Iran, but there's also the Houthi level. What keeps us on defense regarding the Houthis, and what keeps us from taking offense? Do we have a lack of allies? Is that part of our problem in the region?
No, we have a lack of allies that have confidence in us, who won't join us until they know that we're going to go all the way. If you pick a fight with the Houthis, then you really have to pick a fight with the Houthis. And then you really validate what the Saudis tried to do with the Houthis years ago. And the Saudis, of course, are out there saying, there's a reason why Hudaybah Port and why Sana'a and why Aden and so forth are not under your control. There's a reason why these dangerous ports are under Houthi control. The Saudis were about to take them or did take them. But then out of, quote, humanitarian concerns and starvation among the Houthi tribes, we forced the Saudis to back off and open these ports and put them under the control of the Houthis so that the humanitarian aid could flow to the Houthis and stave off a humanitarian crisis. The Saudis were bitter about this. Until they see us as serious in fighting the Houthis, they won't join us. The second thing is, we live in a world where we don't think we can have victory. So we think, okay, we pick a fight with the Houthis, but this is never ending because you can't defeat the Houthis. The Saudis couldn't defeat the Houthis. We can't defeat. So there's a defeatism that affects our strategic thinking in the West. And then finally, you see it with Hamas, you see it with Hezbollah. There's a fear that a decisive victory by us or our allies will trigger a larger war with Iran. Look at what our rhetoric is with Hezbollah right now. Oh, Israel, take it. Take the win. You've killed a number of high-level Hezbollahis. You've done enough. You've already won in Gaza. They can't do it October 7th tomorrow. Forget about a year from now. But tomorrow, just take the win. Don't do anything. Calm down. And let Iran rebuild. The fear of an Iranian intervention, which therefore drives the collapse of the aspiration for a regional condominium with Iran, I think governs everything. And because of that, we've paralyzed ourselves with the Houthis too.
So we've paralyzed ourselves.
Yes.
I wonder how much the Israelis looked at the Saudi experience with the Houthis when the United States and the UN said there was a famine in Gaza, which turns out there wasn't a famine in Gaza. But Israel didn't do what the United States said in Gaza. And I wonder if that's a reaction to having watched the Saudis come close to some victory over the Houthis in the Red Sea and then having stepped back. Now, I'm not sure, but
I think it was more stark. I think it was more stark in Gaza. I mean, first of all, the Saudis were not in a position three years ago or longer to really stand up to the United States on the Yemen issue. They don't have the internal capacity to withstand the withdrawal of U.S. support that Israel in many ways did. So the starvation issue was used and the Saudis had to withdraw. The Israelis, I'm sure, looked at it, but the Israelis also, you know, Gaza means a lot more to Israel than Yemen really did to Saudi Arabia. Gaza's inside Israel. They came into Israel and did this horrific October 7th slaughter. The Israelis are going a long way in giving the United States the access to the, and both reducing tactically their aggressiveness in Gaza and constantly maintaining humanitarian supply and provision of electricity, food, water to Gaza. They have done this to great self-damage strategically in normal circumstances in war. A nation that's been attacked doesn't have to worry about providing electricity to the nation that attacked it. And yet Israel does. It doesn't need to worry about the water pipes that have been torn up to use as fuselages for missiles that strike Tel Aviv, but yet the Israelis are responsible for still getting the water into Gaza, yet they do. In other words, Israel has taken upon itself the humanitarian crisis. And from day one, there's not really been a genuine humanitarian crisis because of that. And it has affected Israel's ability to prosecute this war. They would have been done probably at the end of November or with a 2 week ceasefire, probably in December, or alternatively, if Hamas knew that Israel would come back as strongly after November ceasefire as it was before the November ceasefire, it's quite possible Hamas might not have broke the ceasefire, released the remaining hostages and pulled a PLO and gone into exile. In other words, this attempt by the United States to engage on the humanitarian issue has prolonged this war dramatically, might have cost half the hostages their lives, certainly has cost a lot of Palestinians their lives, and most likely cost a lot of Israeli soldiers their lives. So this is the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
So there's a question that came in to us from a listener asking why it is that we're more concerned with humanitarian aid than with finishing the war. But I think you answered the question. That's a choice that Israel makes for how it behaves, as well as a response to U.S. pressure. And we can talk about the consequences of it, but I think the decision has been made. Let's move to a slightly different part of the conversation, and this is a U.S. part of the conversation. One of the first things that President Joe Biden did in 2021 when he came into office was take the Houthis off the list of terror-supporting countries. And that opened the way for them to get money and to get weapons. Even though the Iranians actually were embargoed from selling weapons, the Houthis were no longer embargoed from receiving weapons. And that didn't work out very well. And in January of this year, President Biden put them back on the terror list. Did either of those two things change the nature of the war in the Red Sea? Did putting them on, did
Yeah,
taking them off the list?
I think taking them off the list allowed them the quiet and the access to materials and money and so forth that allowed them to build into the threat that they are. And by the way, it's not only the Houthi threat, it's now the Houthis have strategic relations using some of the funds and so forth with Somali gangs and Somali factions that could begin to operate now from the other side of the channel and create a dual sort of vice on that. And this is much harder than for us to deal with if that happens. So you do see the strategic deterioration. You see the Iranians having naval access into that area without being threatened. 2 years ago, the Israelis apparently disabled their intelligence ship that was monitoring all this traffic through the Bab el-Mandeb Straits. And then when that was damaged, it had to be towed back to Bandar Abbas port in Iran. And shipping was fine for a while. But then when the Iranians redeployed a new ship a few months ago, that's when you started seeing the shipping go back up. Then when they were afraid that Israel might hit it, they withdrew it and the shipping attacks went down. So it's very clear that Iran's presence there is the intelligence structure of the shipping constriction. Without Iran, without its ships, without its intelligence capabilities, this becomes a problem, although I suppose the Chinese might start filling some of the gap now. But nevertheless, the Houthis still lack that capability, and they surely were building it. But this access to Iran so freely, this access to money, access to technologies that came with being off the list, this definitely helped build the Houthi threat. My understanding is the administration is put them back on the list, but isn't enforcing yet. So they're still really not doing that much there. And that reminds me a bit of what they're doing with Iran, which is no, this administration has not lifted any sanctions formally. They just stopped imposing them. I mean, they just stopped enforcing them. So there's still a lot of that going on because the fear again is if we really decisively act in any way, even sanctions, Iran will react. And then we're in a cycle of violence type equation in their view of the world. So I think it's a real problem.
But we're in a cycle of violence now, you know.
Correct.
So you have this cycle of violence or that cycle of violence. But at the moment,
Yeah.
Iran is running a cycle of violence around Israel. And by the way, beginning to undermine the Kingdom of Jordan. And I know the Jordanians are concerned about that. So what's the difference? It seems to me that
Well,
one
yeah.
cycle of violence will end and the other cycle of violence will
Well, I
continue
think what we
forever.
really aren't in a cycle of violence. What we have is just waves of Iranian attacks or their proxy attacks. Occasionally, there's a response. They calm down a little bit and then they start the next wave of attacks. So I think we're really in just wave after wave rather than a action reaction cycle. Jordan is one of the targets of Iran through the Iraqi militia, but this also, we didn't raise it through the Suez Canal and Red Sea issue. But remember, Aqaba is the only access that Jordan has to the sea,
Right.
and it's also shut down. And that means for Jordan, Israel still has its Mediterranean ports to trade with Europe. Jordan does not. Jordan must trade through Aqaba and Suez to deal with Europe or land bridge with Israel. And of course, the Israelis are fulfilling that role. They have a strategic interest in making sure it doesn't fall in Jordan. But the pressures on Jordan are immense right now. I'm not sure. Combined with, and it's a whole different subject matter, with mistakes that the king has made, I'm very worried about Jordanian stability. Very worried.
That's probably a subject for another webinar because we worry about Jordanian security as well. You raised the Haifa port. Somebody sent in a question asking if you could talk about China in the Haifa port. They got management control over the secondary port, not where the US Navy docks, but the secondary port. Would you talk about China in Haifa and China and Israel?
Yeah, well, Shoshana, you and me were one of those who were very being extremely pro-Israeli. We got a lot of heartburn over that decision years ago to allow China entry into that secondary port. The Israelis have not allowed China to go further and get additional port rights. Instead, they turned and then they also were going to bring in Turkey. They in the end went against Turkey and instead have brought in India. And I think you're seeing that strategic shift mentally in Israel to understanding that there's a Japanese Indian structure emerging that is trying to compete with the Belt and Road Initiative. They don't have the assets to compete that China does, but they are trying to compete. And Israel's sort of on the cusp between one or the other. I actually think this war has clarified for Israel, China. And China's role in Israel. I think the Israelis have been burned badly. I think they're learning now only how deep China's role was in assisting their enemies in this war. And I think it will be one of the post-war strategic reassessments that Israel will undertake, is to fundamentally shift its belief in the ability to deal amicably and businesslike with China. I think that the impact of that has yet fully to be felt, but I think it will be a major affair after the war ends. And I think the port will be a very serious issue to examine at that point. The secondary port will be a very serious issue to examine at that point. And my sense is that you're going to see a play by the Japanese and by the Indians, perhaps with the UAE, perhaps maybe at that point with the Saudis, to try to create an alternative structure And by the way, that's the ultimate strategic pivot is Iran. If Iran falls and you have a different regime, one has to remember Iran and India are culturally linked. These are the two great Indus basin civilizations. They consider each other cousins. And as a result, if ever that happened, you would see a fundamentally different structure emerge strategically that would anchor the entire Fertile Crescent and trade patterns, including Haifa Port. But I think the Israelis simply have to revisit the Chinese issue after the war, and I think Israel will emerge from this war with a different mentality and a vulnerable outlook, which is appropriate to their circumstance and what they need to think.
Yeah, I've sort of wondered if China, if Israel saw itself as an equal to China at some point, it maybe has to rethink that. I think there will be a lot of rethinking. One of the things that probably has to be rethought, someone has written in a question asking if you would talk about, excuse me, the Iranian oil weapon. But I think we need to address energy as a bigger question. The United States has gone in 4 years from being energy independent, actually an exporter of energy. To not, we've cut ourselves off. At the same time, we said that the world was going to embargo Russian oil, which doesn't appear to have happened, driving China and Iran closer, driving Russia and Iran closer. What's the future of the energy market if we stay out, number one? And what's the energy market look like if we come back in?
I think one of the key things right now is the European dependence on Russian gas. And one has to remember 30% of its gas imports come from Algeria. The various pipelines come in through Libya, through Algeria, but they all come together in Hassi El-Rmel in Algeria. So Algeria really holds a chokehold over 30% of the gas imported into Europe, and Russia, of course, has the other. But of course, Algeria is aligned with Iran. And Algeria, by the way, is making noises that it can cut Gibraltar to Israeli shipping. So that's another sea lines of communication issue that could emerge with Algeria joining the Houthis in Iran. But certainly you could see Russia, China, Iran using the gas weapon through Algeria to affect European gas supply. What's the answer to that? I think very seriously, the Israelis have to get very serious and the UAE has to get very serious. If I had one strategic complaint about the previous Israeli government is they didn't take seriously the Israeli gas scene, and they blew it. They literally blew it in two ways. One is to further exploitation of Israeli gas, and two, to position Israel to become the hub, the Eastern Mediterranean hub of all gas coming in from the Persian Gulf through pipelines to Israel and then through offshore structures to Europe, which would position Israel as a potential alternative to Algerian gas. Instead, Israel dropped the ball with that and wrote it off. I think it was a major mistake, but this is a major strategic potential still. And I think this can be picked up quite rapidly. It would require a crash program to come into the, for most of these things take, offshore platforms take 4 years or so to make. So if, but a crash program could bring them online in a year or two. We have to think we're at war, and at war you get things done quickly. At peace you have timelines. At war you don't. You do it fast. If the Manhattan Project in 1940 had been conceived of in peacetime, we'd be roughly around now getting our nuclear weapon. Instead it took 4 years, 3 years. This is wartime versus peacetime. The Israelis have to think wartime. The Americans have to think wartime. The other thing is the United States has to fundamentally change its understanding of both the provision of hydrocarbons and drop the issue of zero emissions. Find more efficient. Gas is more efficient than oil. And it, less, if you want green energy, it's a good way station. You're not going to get to zero. And then second of all, the big revolution is storing energy, which is batteries. But batteries need lithium, they need cobalt, they need titanium, they need vanadium, they need all these things. And where is that? It's in Africa. Again, we're back to the African question, the littoral question, the port question, the Belt and Road Initiative, freedom of seas. So again, if you really want to invigorate strategically the energy sector and make the West non-vulnerable to it, then you're really going to have to get serious about freedom of navigation, African strategy, maintain the sea lines of communication, work with the Israelis, the UAE, and the Saudis to create like that Middle East trade corridor, a Middle East pipeline corridor that comes out in Ashdod and Haifa and a offshore facility, really pool East Med gas exploration together to get that out to Europe and start having structures.
So what I see and what I think worries me is you have to think fast. We have to think fast. And we don't. And until 1941, when Pearl Harbor actually happened, we kept hoping that it wasn't going to happen. We could do lend lease with the British, and we gave support to the British in all kinds of ways. But we didn't see ourselves at war. And I think it's equally true right now that we don't see ourselves at war. That's one thing that Israel does. It knows it's at war. We don't seem to. So you've given us a picture of the energy side of things where we probably need to reconstruct our entire energy theory. What is it we're going to do? What is it we're going to have? And who are we going to have it with? On the one side. The other side is you have to rethink the entire military strategy. What do we need to protect this? What do we need to protect that? And with whom are we going to protect it? So it was one thing to let Israel into CENTCOM and say, now you're part of the American structure that's going to defend the Red Sea and it's going to defend the Middle East and, all of those things. But it's another if CENTCOM doesn't actually actively defend things. So should we be pessimistic? We're getting close to the end of the program. And
I think you're right. I mean,
people know.
look,
Go ahead.
Israel was asleep on October 7th. It was completely asleep. You don't need to look further. I mean, we can have long debates over what conceptions failed, was Oslo response, blah, blah, blah. But the truth was, even under all these bad ideas, if Israel had been attentive, very attentive, and watching everything like a hawk on October 7th, it had the power to respond and stop it. It didn't because it was complacent. Israel has learned that lesson. It is not complacent now. It is emerging as the West's strategic conscience, essentially. So we had a whole bunch of threats here. One is Israeli power anchors a strategic alliance. Israeli positioning can anchor a gas or energy structure, trade structure, global trade structure. Well, Israel, in some ways, is just the front line, and the front line feels things before the homeland does. And Israel feels it. It is awake. It is strategically suffering bandwidth issues right now. But deep down, they are beginning to enter this period of strategic effervescence. And the United States can shortcut a lot of its own thinking if it's simply pays attention to where the Israelis are heading, because a lot of this stuff will emerge in Israel, and so Israel can play not, instead of CENTCOM being basically American support for Saudi Arabia with a bunch of appendages, it really becomes a regional structure anchored to Saudi Arabia, the Gulf, Israel, and this linkage that it represents between the European theater and India on East. It really does become the security structure. And but in that, Israel really is beginning to emerge not only as its position, but also intellectually as a nation that is awake. And I think that's important, right, to pay attention to at this point.
So normally when somebody says somebody's woke, I worry about what they are, but in this case it's okay. So as we're coming to the end of the program, people who listen know that I like to go out on a positive note. You've given us a lot of negative notes, but I think you've just hit an extremely positive note for Israel to say that they are woke or awakened to the larger regional issues. So, are you prepared to be positive for the United States? What has to happen for us to join the party here? Because without us, It's a very small party. Even if you have India and you have Israel and you have Japan and you have the UAE and all of that. But somebody wrote in here a very depressing thought. If Iran has nuclear weapons, a nuclear weapon on Saudi Arabia would change the entire nature of the world's energy picture. So, is there any hope that the United States will have its woke moment and start reevaluating those things, such as energy, such as security, such as allies and alliances? Or are
I
we
think
going to muddle?
I think we're going to muddle a bit, but I do think we're about to get a shock. I think, so much of the world's power, world structure is anchored to American power, including even in inimical structures like the UN. I mean, without American power, the UN is useless. Even the Human Rights Commission in the UN is meaningless if we pull out. So at the end of the day, I think such a collapse of American global power leads to a challenge which wakes us up, which is kind of a negative way to get to a positive. But that said, I think those of us who lived through the 70s watched these Palestinian encampments and the burning of the American flag, the attack on America. And I think that you're beginning to see the reaction out there. I think you begin, Americans don't really care about Gaza, and some Americans care about Israel, sort of, but it's not the first thing on their mind. But they do care about America looking pathetic. They care about America looking weak, and they care about America looking fickle to its allies. And it damages our image of ourselves. We believe that our moral fiber is the core of our strength, and that this does not look good morally. So the United States, I think what you're seeing is, having lived through the end of the 70s, I'm sensing the very first signs of that awakening in America. Again, I don't want to use woke, I mean a different awakening with an A, not an O. And I think you saw it in that moment in the campuses when that North Carolina, the president raised the flag and then the fraternities came to defend it. I think it had more of a cultural impact than we think. It didn't spread all the way, but it did seem to be the high watermark of the Palestinian encampment movement. They've been more or less on the defensive, and they've now taken it out of the campuses, partly because the campuses are shut down because of the summer, and they're taking it to the streets, and I'm sure this summer will be a hot summer. But they're also morphing into the larger issue of Antifa, and they're beginning to blur a little bit, but I think genuinely there's a reaction. By the way, in Europe, you're seeing it too to some extent, that this is this failure is an elite-driven failure, and there's a genuine sense in America that our elites have failed us, and in Europe too, and that there's a real move afoot to essentially reject elites, and with that could come a big change.
Yeah, positive or negative.
Positive or negative, but I have faith in Americans believing in themselves. I have faith in our fundamentals.
I'll take that as a positive.
Yeah,
I
I mean,
think
I'm
when
worried about the
Americans believe in
25 to 40
ourselves,
year olds, but I see it even among the 25-year-olds and under. They don't think anything things are right. So I think that something's afoot.
And on that note, we're going to end the program. And I'm going to make a promise that I will invite you back to see how this plays out. Because if you're right, and I think you are right, we're standing on the precipice of something. And the question is what? So I'm going to leave it with the question. I'm going to leave it with your semi-positive answer. And thank you for what I think is a really enlightening look at a region where maybe we've just been too narrowly focused in on Gaza and those sorts of, and you need to sometimes to raise your eyeballs. So thank you for raising our eyeballs.